And my goal is to make you want to read it. So I'm going to tell you everything there is about the plot, and I'll ruin that. I'll try not to do that. The first time I picked up the Song of Solomon was quite a while ago, and I went right to the Song of Solomon in the Bible, and just kind of I reread that, and thought that that would prepare me for this, and I'm telling you that because it has absolutely nothing to do with this. So, don't. Let's go back to that. I'm going to talk about some characters and read some excerpts for you. And the characters in this book, I'll talk about them later. I don't even know if you can read that. It'll just help us remember who's who as I get to certain scenes. But I thought I would start by asking you, what do you think it takes to make a great book? What ingredients? You know, you guys read, I know that. What is it that attracts you to a book and makes you want to read more by that author or read? What makes you want to read?
Interesting what are you looking for? Characters.
First thing, I'll put it down. A character or characters.
It's something I'm interested in.
So, of course, interest. Now, in the subject, in what are you interested in?
The subject.
Okay. Now, if I told you the Song of Solomon is about this kind of crazy family that has a really crazy woman in it, and people are stealing gold, and or they think they are, does that sound interesting?
Good.
Oh, it does. Okay. Well, I want that theory. Okay. What else? Characters.
Conflict.
What? A conflict. And yeah. And the, and the. Okay. Good.
Mystery.
Mystery. That, right beside that. We're going to make it so far. So far we got all this. We do have characters in this novel. We have conflict, we have mystery. Keep going.
Revelation.
What do you mean by that?
Well, something is revealed or they come from some kind of an awareness.
You do or?
The characters.
The characters do.
Maintaining suspense.
I'll put that up here with conflict and suspense, yeah. So that takes care of my reading certain parts of the plot. I won't do it. I don't want to ruin your suspense. How about language? Are we aware of that as you read? I'm going to encourage you to become. Go ahead.
Like style of writing?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And the metaphors that are used, and are they perfect? Are they exact? The reason I bring that up is that. For whatever it's worth, and tomorrow we're going to talk about whoever wants to come back. Sophie's Choice by William Styron. I don't think there's a writer in American literature who uses language better than he does, and it's one of the things that lifts that up in ways that some other books aren't lifted up, and lifts up language in ways that, and therefore lifts up his topic, his mystery, his characters, everything in ways that some people can't do it. And I'm going to put that down because I think. I can't read that, can you? I think that Toni Morrison has great use of language as well. Then I would throw out three other things. Let's ask ourselves, and I'll ask you this at the end of the session today before we head over for Vespers. What is the central purpose of this story? And you might not know, but think of any story that you've read recently, biblical, a passage, anything. What's the central purpose of that? And then ask yourself, how well is that purpose accomplished? And then ask yourself, and how important is that purpose to me? Just for a second, a couple seconds, do that with a TV show. One that you watch, but it isn't, it's just kind of interesting. And, but I'm thinking of dramas, not documentaries and news magazines and that kind of thing. So, are we old enough to have watched, what's the one that took place in Texas? And
Dallas.
Dallas. Did you anybody here watch Dallas? Yeah. So go back, pull that out just for a second, or if you got a modern one, leave it. What's the central purpose? How well is it accomplished? And how important is it? What do you think the central purpose of Dallas was?
Entertainment.
Yeah, I think so. And then, but we're entertained and we watch it. I remember watching. Was it what's the guy's name? I can't remember any of these characters.
JR
gets shot, and he gets shot like in April, and you got to find out in November who shot JR. It was in all the newspapers and everything else. I wanted to know who shot it. I didn't really care. And so that after that third question, how important is that purpose? But we're entertained, we want to find out, so we do. But the great novel has an important purpose. So let's just see if, as we look at the Song of Solomon, how we might answer ourselves those three questions. What is the central purpose? Is it well accomplished? And I think we can do that even without having yet read it. And finally, how important is that purpose? So I'll introduce some things to you. I'll tell you a little bit about this book. Okay, way back in the history, before this book starts, Jake married Sing, and they had two kids. And now the novel starts. Their two kids are Macon and Pilot. I'm sure you know, but just in case you don't, Toni Morrison's African-American. Her characters are African-American, all her main characters. Macon and Pilot are brother and sister. They have totally different values in life. The title of the session was A Different Way of Seeing, A Different Way of Thinking. We are enslaved by our consumer mentality, and Pilot, Toni Morrison, through this character Pilot, will teach us how to fly, to adopt a different kind of values, and we'll see what it's revealed. Pilot has, I don't want to call it an affair because it's only a one-night thing, because Pilot has no navel. That's her birth defect. Now, how can anybody not have a navel? And she doesn't realize that that's anything different. But this one night with this guy, he wakes up in the morning and says, "My God, what are you, some kind of mermaid?" And he never has anything, and nobody does, has anything ever to do with her again. And she is ostracized from all community and all individual intimate relationships because of this silly. I think that's why Toni Morrison picked it. It's not that she's a homely woman. It's not that she's stupid. It's that she doesn't have a navel. And, like, who cares? But that's what causes this being ostracized from intimate relationships and society. Macon, on the other hand, is a successful businessman. He owns a lot of property, and he walks around all day, and the book tells him he's fondling his keys to all these buildings that he rents. And you'll hear him talk in a second. But he's very different because she is not a part of the culture, she develops a different kind of values and thereby teaches us that one can survive and maybe even thrive and transcend the values that Macon adopts, which are, I'm going to make money and I'm going to own things. Macon marries Ruth, and they have three kids. One that we'll talk about a lot is their son named Milkman, who is really Macon the second. But he's named Milkman because his mother nurses him too long. His feet dangle to the floor. He's already eating out of a cereal bowl. He's probably 8 years old, and she still nurses him. And we hear, and we won't get into this part of the novel, but we hear all kinds of stories about Ruth and how strange she is. And she must be sick if she's going to nurse her son when he's eight. And Macon tells his son about his wife, or Macon the second, or Milkman's mother, that I think she had a real weird affair with her father. And my point in bringing that up but not developing it is that in this novel, the truth and reality unfolds in the same way it does in our lives. We hear this and develop an idea, like Milkman does about his mother. And then he comes to know her, and a different truth is revealed. And we'll try to progress through that without emphasizing it, how that unfolds in the novel as well. And we'll look at that specifically, and you'll be with me as soon as I get to it. And Pilot has this one-night affair and has a daughter, and her daughter has a one-night affair, and she has a daughter, and they're the main characters. Okay. It's fun to, if you were at David Wee's session today, he ended with a quote from Flannery O'Connor that said, "I think you teachers strain the soup too much." And I think what she meant by that is that we want to get into our stuff and miss out the novel, and miss out on the novel. I don't do that. You're going to hear more from the novel than you are from me. And here we go. And interrupt me anytime, ask a question if something I'm reading isn't clear in its context. And I'll try to explain it for you. Okay, Macon and Pilate had been separated for years. Their father, when they were kids, was murdered by a white man, shot off a fence and blown 10 feet in the air, as they describe it. And as they find out that they're homeless, their mother has died because in giving birth to Pilate, that's when that umbilical cord broke and just disappeared from Pilate. She died too. So these kids are homeless. And Macon, actually, the older brother, has to raise Pilate for a couple of years, and he does. And she is the most important thing in the world to him. But for some other wonderful plot things happen, they get separated and they come back together 16 years later. Come back when he is now 16, and here's the narration. He had not seen her since he was 16 years old, until a year before the birth of his own son, when she appeared in his city. And now she was acting like an in-law, like an aunt, dabbling at helping Ruth and the girls, but having no interest in or knowledge of decent housekeeping, she just got in the way. How far down she had slid since then. She had cut the last thread of propriety. At one time, she had been the dearest thing in the world to him. Now she was odd, murky, and worst of all, unkempt. A regular source of embarrassment. Why can't you dress like a woman? He was standing by the stove. What's that sailor's cap doing on your head? Don't you have stockings? What are you trying to make me look like in this town? Like common street women you walk around. I've been worried sick about you too, Megan. They meet. We find out what's wrong. Pilate lived in a narrow single-story house whose basement seemed to be rising from rather than settling into the ground. She had no electricity because she would not pay for the service, nor for gas. At night, she and her daughter lit the house with candles and kerosene lamps. They warmed themselves and cooked with wood and coal, pumped kitchen water into a dry sink through a pipeline from a well, and lived, I love this sentence, pretty much as though progress was a word that meant walking a little farther on down the road. It was the absence of a navel that convinced people that she had not come into this world through normal channels, had never lain, floated, or grown in some warm and liquid place connected by a tissue-thin tube to a reliable source of nourishment. It's clear she is really in a different world. Come on in, grab a chair, grab one of these. You'll sleep a lot better if you're sitting. Macon is clearly embarrassed by the sister who's come back. He's a big man. He gets loans from the bank in the days when not many black men can. And now he's got the sister, like a common street woman, who's coming around. But one day on the way home from work, he was rapidly approaching a part of the road where the music could not follow when he saw, like a scene on the back of a postcard, a picture of where he was headed, his own home, his wife's narrow, unyielding back, his daughters boiled dry from years of yearning, his son to whom he could speak only if his words held some command or criticism. Hello, Daddy. Hello, son. Tuck in your shirt. I found a dead bird, Daddy. Don't bring that mess in this house. There was no music there. And tonight, he wanted just a bit of music from the person who had been his first caring for. I wrote in my margin the first time I ever read this, even Macon cannot live by bread alone. He turned back and walked slowly toward Pilate's house. They were singing some melody that Pilate was leading, a phrase that the other two were taking, that's the daughter Reba and the granddaughter Hagar, a phrase that the other two were taking up and building on, her powerful contralto, Reba's piercing soprano and counterpoint, and the soft voice of the girl Hagar, who must be about 10 or 11 now. It pulled him like a carpet tack under the influence of a magnet. Surrendering to the sound, Macon moved closer. This is the house. He doesn't even want to get near this woman. He has told his son already, you can't go near her. She is a snake, is his word. and why he thinks he's a snake is a wonderful part of the novel. Make him move closer. He wanted no conversation, no witness, only to listen and perhaps to see the three of them, the source of that music that made him think of fields and wild turkey and calico. Treading as lightly as he could, he crept up to the side window where the candlelight flickered lowest and peeped in. Reba was cutting her toenails with a kitchen knife or a switchblade, her long neck bent almost to her knees. The girl Hagar was braiding her hair, while Pilate, whose face he could not see because her back was to the window, was stirring something in a pot. Wine pulp, perhaps? Megan knew it was not food she was stirring, for she and her daughters ate like children, whatever they had a taste for. No meal was ever planned or balanced or served, nor was there any gathering at the table. Pilate might bake hot bread, and each one of them would eat it with butter whenever she felt like it. Or there might be grapes left over from the winemaking, or peaches for days on end. If one of them bought a gallon of milk, they drank it until it was gone. If another got a half bushel of tomatoes or a dozen ears of corn, they ate them until they were gone too. They ate what they had or came across or had a craving for. Profits from their wine selling evaporated like seawater in a hot wind, going for junk jewelry for Hagar, Reba's gifts to men, and he didn't know what all. Near the window, hidden by the dark, he felt the irritability of the day drain from him and relished the effortless beauty of the women singing in the candlelight. Reba's soft profile, Hagar's hands moving in her heavy hair, and Pilate. He knew her face better than he knew his own. Singing now, her face would be a mask. All emotion and passion would have left her features and entered her voice. But he knew that when she was neither singing nor talking, her face was animated by her constantly moving lips. She chewed things. As a baby, as a very young girl, she kept things in her mouth. Straw from brooms, gristle, buttons, seeds, leaves, string, and her favorite, when he could find some for her, rubber bands and India rubber erasers. Well, this woman obviously has a different attitude toward life. I'm going to skip up to something and then come back. I didn't write this in my notes, but you should hear it. I'll come back to Pilate, but this is the best illustration I can find in a novel of Macon's attitude toward life and toward what matters in life. He's just told his son to stay away from Pilate. Boy, you got better things to do with your time. Besides, it's time you started learning how to work. You start Monday. After school, come to my office, work a couple of hours there, and learn what's real. I'm going to write that word in big letters on the board. Because what's real, not very big, is it? Remember. and learn what's real. Pilate can't teach you a thing you can use in this world. Maybe the next, but not this one. Let me tell you right now the one important thing you'll ever need to know. Own things. And let the things you own other things. And then you'll own yourself and other people too. Starting Monday, I'm going to teach you how. That's the woman they have to stay away from. This is why. Milkman goes anyway. I mean, you know what you do, right? When I wanted our kids, don't mow the lawn. Boy, they mow the lawn. You know.
Yeah.
You all. So Milkman goes with his best friend, whose name is Guitar. He's another main character in the book that we won't get to, but a wonderful character who's got some strange assignments for himself. They go to Pilate's house. Before I read this, I'll just pay attention to the writing here, too. The language that Toni Morrison uses, and descriptions and so on. They found her on the front steps, sitting wide-legged in a long-sleeved, long-skirted black dress. Her hair was wrapped in black, too, and from a distance, all they could really see beneath her face was the bright orange she was peeling. She was all angles, he remembered later, knees mostly, and elbows, 1 foot pointed east and 1 foot pointed west. As they came closer and saw the brass box dangling from her ear, what we learn is that her name was given to her out of the Bible. Her dad was blind, and he just opened the Bible and pointed to it, and it was Pilate. And everybody said, "You can't call our daughter that." Why not? So my finger pointed to, well, you don't have to do it. Yes, I have to do it. God said, God will be mad at you. God took away my wife. Name her Pilate. Well, Pilate is spelled P-I-L-A-T-E, but she is clearly, and you can encourage you to read the novel, you'll clearly see that she is a pilot, too. A pilot who changes course in life. As they came close, so she put that name in a snuff box and carried it in her earring. As they came closer and saw the brass box dangling from her ear, Milkman knew that what with the earring, the orange, and the angled black cloth, nothing, not the wisdom of his father nor the caution of the world, could keep him from her. Guitar, being older and already in high school, had none of the reluctance that his young buddy still struggled with and was the first one to speak. Hi! The woman looked up, first at Guitar and then at Milkman. What kind of a word is that? Her voice was light, but gravel sprinkled. Milkman kept on staring at her fingers, manipulating the orange. Guitar grinned and shrugged. It means hello. Well then, say what you mean. Okay, hello. That's better. What you want? Nothing, we just passing by. Look like you standing by. If you don't want us here, Miss Pilot, we'll go, the Guitar spoke softly. I ain't the one with the wants. You're the one who wants something. We want to ask you something. Guitar stopped feigning indifference. She was too direct, and to keep up with her, he had to pay careful attention to his language. Ask it. Somebody said you ain't got no navel. That the question? Yes. Don't sound like a question. Sound like an answer. Give me the question. Do you? Do I what? Do you have a navel? No. What happened to it? Beats me. She dropped a bright peeling into her lap and separated an orange section slowly. Now, do I get to ask you a question? Sure. Now, she knows Milkman is her nephew, and there's a whole bunch of voodoo that she practiced to get this kid to be born because his father wanted him killed or aborted. Who's your little friend? This here's Milkman. Do we talk? Pilot swallowed a piece of the fruit. Yeah, he talk. Say something. Guitar shoved an elbow at Milkman without taking his eyes off Pilot. Milkman took a breath, held it, and said, hi. Pilot laughed. You all must be the dumbest unhung Negroes on earth. What they telling you them in them schools? You say hi to pigs and sheep when you want them to move. When you tell a human being hi, you ought to get up and knock you down. Shame had flooded him. He had expected to feel it, but not that kind. To be embarrassed, like his father was embarrassed. To be embarrassed, yes, but not this way. She was the one who was ugly, dirty, poor, and drunk. The queer aunt whom his sixth grade schoolmates teased him about, and whom he hated because he personally felt responsible for her ugliness, her poverty, her dirt, and her wine. But instead, she was making fun of his school, of his teachers, of him. And while she looked as poor as everyone said she was, something was missing from her eyes that should have confirmed it. Nor was she dirty. Unkempt, yes, but not dirty. The whites of her fingernails were like ivory, and unless he knew absolutely nothing, this woman was definitely not drunk. Of course, she was anything but pretty, yet he knew he could have watched her all day. The fingers pulling thread veins from the orange sections, the berry black lips that made her look as though she wore makeup, the earring. And when she stood up, he all but gasped. She was as tall as his father, head and shoulders taller than himself. Her dress wasn't as long as he had thought. It came to just below her calf, and now he could see her unlaced men's shoes and the silvery brown skin of her ankles. She held the peelings precisely as they'd fallen in her lap, and as she walked up the steps, she looked as though she were holding her crotch. Your daddy wouldn't like that. He don't like dumb peoples. Then she looked right at Milkman, one hand holding the peelings, the other on the doorknob. I know your daddy. I know you, too. Again, Guitar spoke up. You his daddy's sister? The only one he's got. Ain't but three deads alive. Their last name is Dead. Because the father, Jake, here was asked. He couldn't read, he couldn't write, and he'd been injured in the war. And they said, what's your name? And he couldn't, and he didn't answer. So the guy right now just wrote down Dead. And then he was from Macon, Georgia, so he gave him the name Macon Dead, and that's what it happens. And there's a whole, it's another whole theme. How do people get their names, and what do they mean? Well, we'll continue. Ain't but three deads alive. Milkman would be unable to get one word out of his mouth after the foolish high heard himself shouting, I'm a dead, my mother's dead, my sisters, you and him ain't the only ones. What do you have right there? I'm a dead, and I'm proud, and you are too. And already this woman has worked her magic on this kid. Well, any responses to, you said, characters? How many people like Macon Platt? Right away. No, wait, I mean, this is, okay. Well, you're going to like her more in a second. The boys are still there. And she tells a story about, and that's where I tried to write the word reality. She tells a story about a time in the woods when she was afraid of something, but it was all in her imagination, and it wasn't real. And this is the story she tells those two boys. It's really one of the great illustrations in American literature. I say that about 1,400 times a year. There's a lot of good stuff there. Well, now, we lost. She's telling the story, but she and her brother were lost. Now, we lost, and there was this wind, and in front of us was the back of our daddy. We were some scared children. Macon kept telling me that the things we were scared of wasn't real. What difference do it make if the thing you're scared of is real or not? I remember doing laundry for a man and his wife once, down in Virginia. The husband came into the kitchen one afternoon shivering and saying, did I have any coffee made? I asked him what it was that had grabbed hold of him. He looked so bad. He said he couldn't figure it out, but he felt like he was about to fall off a cliff. Standing right there on that yellow and white and red linoleum as level as a flat iron, he was holding on to the door first, then the chair, trying his best not to fall down. I opened my mouth to tell him, wasn't no cliff in that kitchen. And then I remembered how it was being in those woods. I felt it all over again. Remember what it was? It doesn't happen to be real if you're afraid you're afraid. Okay. Then I remembered how it was being in those woods, and I felt it all over again. So I told the man that he wanted me to hold on to him so he couldn't fall. He looked at me with the most grateful look in the world. He said, I walked round back of him and locked my fingers in front of his chest and held on to him. His heart was kicking under his vest like a mule in heat, but little by little it calmed down. You saved his life, said Qatar. No such thing. His wife come in before it was time to let go. She asked me what I was doing, and I told her. Told her what? What'd you say? The truth, that I was trying to keep you from falling off a cliff. I bet he wished he had jumped off then. She believed you? Don't tell me she believed you. Not right away, she didn't. But as soon as I let go, he fell, dead weight to the floor. Smashed his glasses and everything. Fell right on his face, and you know what? He went down so slow, I swear it took 3 minutes, 3 whole minutes, to go from a standing upright position to when he mashed his face on the floor. I don't know if the cliff was real or not, but it took him 3 minutes to fall down it. Was he dead? Asked Qatar. Stone dead. I'd like to hear your responses to that. Pilate, early in the novel, lives in a completely different world where reality is different. And she senses that reality, and how does she move in that different reality? Just go back to what she says to this guy. Don't worry, there's no cliff here. What does she say? Can I hold you? She steps into this unreality of this guy that is so real that somehow this woman is establishing a connection with him that nobody else has. But what happens? In comes a different reality. You better let go of my husband. What are you doing holding on to him? Okay. But then, what's the real reality? It took him 3 whole minutes to fall. So we're early in this novel, we're already asking, what's true in the world? What's real in the world? And is it really right that the thing you want to do is own things, because then you'll own yourself and you'll own others too, and I'm going to teach you how. That's a reality. And so Toni Morrison already opens to us a whole, it's imagination, of course, but a whole new imaginative world to live in. And is it possible to live in this world? And Milkman just heard this story, and he's trapped in a reality that says, get over here and work, and you own things, and you pay attention to collecting the rent and so on. And the whole novel is about his trying to figure out the reality of pilot. Yeah,
what era is this written in?
Well, it was written in the 70s or 80s, but the era is probably the 40s.
Mm-hmm. And it's in Georgia?
It's all over. It started, Macon was in Georgia, but it's in Pennsylvania, it's in Michigan. The setting, it's really kind of, those of you who have read it, it's kind of hard to figure out where they are, and that's on purpose. This is a novel about finding a place that's different than a geographic place, to find this. So we have Danville. Is it Danville, Pennsylvania? Is it Danville, Illinois? We never are told. And they jump off of a building. One guy jumps off a building over Lake Michigan, but he ends up somewhere in Lake Erie. And so the place, the setting is not so nebulous, but not, it's not exact either, but the place sure is nebulous. Well, that's one kind of reality, and here's another. This is all early in the novel. The boys, Milkman and his friend Guitar, are still with her. And Hagar walks in. Hagar, Pilot looked around the room. This here's your brother, Milkman. Now, I've got this up here. What is he?
Cousin.
Okay. Maybe even second. Okay. Hagar, Pilot looked around the room. This here's your brother, Milkman, and this is his friend. What's your name again, pretty? Guitar. Guitar. You play any? She asked. That ain't her brother, Mama. They cousins. Reba's there. That ain't her brother, Mama. They cousins, the older woman spoke. Same thing, says Pilot. No, it ain't, is it, baby? No, said Hagar. It's different. See there, it's different. Well, this is Pilot. Well, what is the difference, Reba? You know so much. Reba looked at the ceiling. A brother is a brother if you both got the same mother, or if you both... Pilot interrupted her, and I'll go back to that, and I'll just give you the interruption. A brother is a brother if you both got the same mother, or if you both... I mean, what's the difference in the way you act toward him? Don't you have to act the same way to both? That's not the point, Mama. Where are we? Pilot. It's a whole different world. And brothers and sisters and all, and boy, we get pretty unconventional thinking, don't we? At this point, I get to teach this novel off and on, and I've always given this analogy to students. We have a pretty big lawn, and we live close to the river, the Mississippi River, and you guys know, I'm sure, that the farmers in Iowa and Illinois and all down the river, they dump there, and we do it on our lawns, too. There are herbicides and pesticides on the lawn, on their land, and it goes into the tributaries, gets the Mississippi River. And before the BP came, there was 5,000 square miles of dead space in the Gulf of Mexico. So I knew about that. I'm not going to put chemicals on our lawn. So a couple times a year, I would sit on my butt and just scoot along and dig up the dandelions and the crabgrass and put them in a bucket and throw them away. And I'd say, aren't you proud of me? That I do that, and Toni Morrison wouldn't be. She would say, what would she say? Learn to love dandelions. So this radical step for her is like loving dandelions, not like just, it's a whole different reality. I'm not contributing to the pollution, but I'm still doing what? I bought into the value of a nice, trim, green lawn. I'm not against green lawns. I helped mow today. But I wondered all the time, why do we do this? No. Because we start breathing. Well, you're with me, right? And you're with Toni Morrison. This is a different reality. Well, we have more wonderful. Here's Pilot with somebody that has really created a life and death scene. Reba, as her character unfolds, has a lot of men. She's not a whore. She just moves from relationships, and there's nothing, we don't hear anything about sex at all. So it's not that. It's about, she just moves from relationship to relationship. And she had this boyfriend who was physically abusing her. And here's the scene with that. Oh, and what's great about that is Reba gives away everything she has. I mean, she wins the lottery. She always seems to win door prizes, and she gives them all away. Everything she gets, you heard that from the very beginning. You might not remember it. But, and Reba, whatever she's doing, she's giving it away. Well, Reba's new man friend had asked her for a small loan, and she had told him that she didn't have any money at all. And, of course, that's true, because if she did, she'd give it away. The man who had received two or three nice presents from her unasked thought she was lying and was trying to tell him to shove off. They were quarreling in the backyard. That is, the man was quarreling. Reba was crying and trying to convince him that what she had said was true. And just as Milkman came in, just after Milkman opened the door, Hagar came running from the bedroom where she had been looking out the back window. She screamed to Pilate, "Mama, he's hitting her. I saw him with his fist, Mama." Pilate looked up from a fourth grade geography book. That's a symbol, and she's always reading this geography book. That has something. No, she's reading the Bible. She looked up from her fourth grade geography book she was reading and closed it. Slowly, it seemed to Milkman, she walked over to a shelf that hung over the dry sink, put the geography book on it, and removed a knife. Slowly still, she walked out the front door. There was no back door. And as soon as she did, Milkman could hear Reba's screams and the man's curses. It didn't occur to him to stop Pilate. Her mouth was not moving and her earring flashed fire. But he did follow her, as did Hagar, around to the back of the house where, approaching the man from the back, she whipped her right arm around his neck and positioned the knife at the edge of his heart. She waited until the man felt the knife point before she jabbed it skillfully about a quarter of an inch through his shirt into the skin. Still holding his neck so he couldn't see, but could feel the blood making his shirt sticky, she talked to him. "Now, I'm not going to kill you, honey. Don't you worry none. Just be still a moment. The heart's right here. But I'm not going to stick it in any deeper, because if I stick it in any deeper, it'll go straight through your heart. So you have to be real still. You hear? You can't move an inch, because I might lose control. It's just a little hole now, honey. No more to pin scratch. You might lose about 2 tablespoons of blood, but no more. And if you're real still, honey, I can get it back without no mistake. But before I do that, I thought we'd have a little talk." The man closed his eyes. Sweat ran from his temples down the sides of his face. A few neighbors who had heard Reba's screams had gathered in Pilate's backyard. And this is what you get. They knew right away that the man was a newcomer to the city. Otherwise, he would have known a few things about Reba, one of which was that she gave away everything she had, and if there was a case quarter in that house, she'd have given it to him. And more important, he would have known not to fool with anything that belonged to Pilate, who never bothered anybody, was helpful to everybody, but who was also believed to have the power to step out of her skin, set a bush afire from 50 yards, and turn a man into a right rutabaga. All on account of the fact that she had no navel. So they didn't have much sympathy for him. They just craned their necks to hear better what Pilate was telling him. "You see, darling, that there is the only child I got. The first baby I ever had. And if you could turn around and see my face, which of course you can't because it might cause my hand might slip, you'd know she's also the last. Women are foolish, you know, and mamas are the most foolish of all. And you know how mamas are, don't you? You got a mama, ain't you? Sure you have. So you know what I'm talking about. Mamas get hurt and nervous when somebody don't like the children. First real misery I ever had in my life was when I found out somebody, a little teeny tiny boy it was, didn't like my little girl. Made me so mad I didn't know what to do. We do the best we can, but we ain't got the strength you men got. That's why it makes us so sad if a grown man start beating up on one of us. You know what I mean? I'd hate to pull this knife out and have you try some other time to act mean to my little girl. Because one thing I know for sure, whatever she done, she's been good to you. Still, I'd hate to push it in more and have your mama feel like I do now. I confess, I don't know what to do. Maybe you can help me. Tell me, what should I do? I love this. Let me go, he whispered. Let me go. I won't never put a hand on her. I promise. A real promise, sugar? Yeah, I promise. You won't never see me no more. Reba sat on the ground, her arms around her knees, staring through her unswollen eye at the scene as though she were at a picture show. Her lip was split, and her cheek was badly bruised. And though her skirt and hands were stained with her effort to stop the blood pouring from her nose, a little still trickled down. Pilate plucked the knife out of the man's shirt and took her arm away. He lurched a little, looked down at the blood on his clothes and up at Pilate, and licking his lips, backed all the way to the side of the house. Under Pilate's gaze, her lips didn't start moving again until he was out of sight and running down the road. What do you think, Pilate? And, well, we have one more important. We have lots of important parts, but this is from the narration, and I think good novels reveal to us the story through the actions of the characters more than they do through the narration. But of course, the narration is important. And here the narrator steps in right after Pilate had this one-night stand with this guy. And I mentioned what he said. He said, "What are you, some kind of mermaid?" One man had shouted and reached hurriedly for his socks. And the narration steps in. It isolated her. Remember, she's homeless. Her mom is dead. Her dad is murdered by white men. Already without family, she was further isolated from her people. For except for the relative bliss on that she had lived on an island for a while before they found out she didn't have a navel. And I think as we think more about this, this is really important that it's such an innocuous thing. Who cares if you don't have a navel? But it's all it takes to be isolated from this community is. And so no wonder an African American write about that. What does it take to be isolated? No navel, black skin, homosexual, all the things that we set up that are part of what you must be. Pilate lives in a whole other reality. But you'll see why. Every other resource was denied her. Partnership in marriage, confessional friendship, and communal religion. Men frowned, women whispered and shoved their children behind them. Remember what her brother did? Don't go see her, she's a snake. even a traveling sideshow would have rejected her, since her freaked quality lacked that important ingredient, the grotesque. There was really nothing to see. Her defect, frightening and exotic as it was a theatrical failure. It needed intimacy, gossip, and the time it took for curiosity to become drama. And then this beautiful page of narration. Finally, Pilate began to take offense. I'm going to write a phrase up here. That I think addresses that question, how important is the central purpose? And this is where Flannery O'Connor says, I think teachers strain the soup too thin. I'm going to give you some thin soup. I'm going to call this a kind of existential stripping. And the existential stripping has to do with, this is who I am. But I'm going to take this off, and I become somebody else. But pretend I have a tie, and I have a three-piece suit, and I have wingtip shoes, or I have my fraternity sweatshirt, or I have my track coach's shirt. All right, but we start to strip away, and then we start to strip away, you'll get it. This is what happened to Pilate after the guy said, "What are you, some kind of mermaid?" Finally, Pilate began to take offense. Although she was hampered by huge ignorances, but not in any way unintelligent, when she realized what her situation in the world was and would probably always be, memorize this line, it'll be on the quiz on Friday. She threw away every assumption she had learned and began at zero. I assume black people are. I assume, I just, Jeannie, my wife just showed me a thing that's coming through on the email now. I didn't look at it, somebody sent it. I've been hard copy, I'm joking. About the struggle that women had for 20 or for 100 years to get to vote. We assume women can't vote. You get the point. She threw away every assumption in the world that she had learned and began at zero. First off, she cut her hair. That was one thing she didn't want to have to think about anymore. Then she tackled the problem of trying to decide how she wanted to live and what was valuable to her. When am I happy and when am I sad and what is the difference? What about Macon? Was he happy at home? Tuck in your shirt. Or was he happy when he was listening to this girl who embarrassed him, his sister, and the music in the house? I won't stop anymore in this. What do I need to know to stay alive? What is true in the world? Her mind traveled crooked streets and aimless goat paths, arriving sometimes at profundity, other times at the revelations of a three-year-old. Throughout this fresh, if common, pursuit of knowledge, one conviction crowned her efforts. Since death held no terrors for her, she spoke often to the dead. She knew there was nothing to fear. That, plus her alien's compassion for troubled people, ripened her and, the consequence of the knowledge she had made up or acquired, kept her just barely within the boundaries of the elaborately socialized world of people. Her dress might be outrageous to them, but her respect for other people's privacy, which they were all very intense about, was balancing. She laughed but never smiled, and in 1963, when she was 68 years old, she had not shed a tear since Circe had brought her cherry jam for breakfast. That's a woman she meets after her dad was killed. She gave up apparently all interest in table manners or hygiene, but acquired a deep concern for and about human relationships. How we doing? You want more? When her father was killed, Macon was old enough to chase the guy that killed him. They run away because this white man killed her father, now that they're to kill Pilate and Macon. So they run away, and they come to a guy sitting in front of a cave, they want to get in there, and he won't let them get in the cave. It's a white guy. And Macon kills him. It's kind of a self-defense thing, but that's not so relevant, really. Macon kills him and then finds gold in the cave. And he puts it all in these sacks and says, come on, Pilate, let's go. She says, we can't take the gold. It's not ours. And he says, what, are you crazy? This will set us up for life. We can't do it. And so he runs, and he sees her picking up this big sack later that he thinks is full of gold. It's not, but he thinks it is. And she's had it hanging in her house since she moved back to Macon's town. Milkman tells her father about this sack. He said, I walked into the sack and it hit my head, and it gave me a hickey on my head. It was so heavy. Gave you a hickey. It's got to be the gold. Steal it. So Guitar and Milkman go into her house and steal the gold, and she sits in the chair watching the whole thing. It's not the gold. It's the bones, she thinks, of the man that Macon killed. Because her father, after he died, came to her and spoke to him and said, you can't just leave a body. If the body's yours, you have to take care of it forever. Well, he meant something else that she doesn't find out until the end of the book. But she thinks it means take care of this body. She thinks she has this guy's bones. So, I can do this fast. It's a wonderful scene. But these two kids get arrested. Now they're black. They get arrested by a white cop because they're breaking and entering. She goes in to get them out of jail. She goes in before Macon comes and hears, oh my gosh, it's my son. He's been arrested. My name in this community, and he's all worried about that. And they're out now, and they're all discussing what happened. They got arrested, and they're hauled into jail. And Guitar, Milkman, and Macon are all talking. They didn't act any different when you got there. What? They acted different when you took that sucker off in the corner and opened your wallet. That's Milkman telling his dad. The only reason he got out is because you were trying to buy your way through everything again. You better be thankful I got a wallet. I am. God knows I am. And that would have been the end of it, except for that Southside nigger. Hadn't been for him, they wouldn't have had to get Pilate down here. Macon rubbed his knees. The idea of having to depend on Pilate to get his son out of jail humiliated him. Raggedy, bootlegging bitch. She's still a bitch, huh? Noteman began. Exhaustion and the sole release of tension made him giddy. He was laughing out loud right now. How she sneaked out of some cave with a big bag of gold that must have weighed 100 pounds over her shoulder all over the country for 50 years and didn't spend none of it, just hung it up from the ceiling like a sack of onions. He's blaming his father for telling him this because they found out now it's just a bundle full of bones. And Milkman's making fun of his father. Milkman put his head back and let the laughter fill the kitchen. Milkman was silent. 50 years, says Milkman. You've been thinking about that gold for 50 years. This is something crazy. Tears of laughter were running from his eyes. Crazy, all of you, just straightened out, laid back crazy. I should have known. The whole thing was crazy. Everything about it was crazy. The whole idea. And Milkman, or Macon, the father asked, well, what's crazier? Her hauling a sack of gold around all this time? Or hauling a dead man's bones around? Huh? Which one? I don't know. I really don't know. If she do one, she could do the other. She's the one they should have kept. When you all told them bones belonged to her, they should have locked her up as soon as she walked in the door. Lock her up for what? After that story she told? He started laughing again. She came in there like Louise Beaver and Butterfly McQueen, all rolled up in one. Now, what she's going to tell is that she came in there and played this Aunt Jemima role. Oh, would Macon be embarrassed about that, right? And here's how it goes. She came in there like Louise Beaver and Butterfly McQueen all rolled. Yes, sir, boss. Yes, sir, boss. She didn't say that. Almost, and she even changed her voice. I told you she was a snake. Dropped her skin in a split second. Dad, she didn't even look the same. She looked short, short and pitiful. That's because she wanted it back. She wanted him to let her have the bones back. Her poor husband's bones that she didn't have no money to buy, bury. Pilate got a husband somewhere? Does the Pope? Well, she got them back. They gave it to her. She knew what she was doing, all right. Yeah, she knew, but how did she know so fast? I mean, she came in there, you know, prepared. She had it all together when she got there. Cop must have told her everything when he picked her up and brought her to the station. Uh-uh. They don't do that. Well, then how did she know? Who knows how Pilate knows? Well, she whined to the policeman, verifying Milkman and Guitar's lie that they had ripped off the sack as a joke on an old lady. That's what she told him. Then give me these bones back so we're not in trouble. Let's go home. She had to look up at him, and her hands were shaking as she described how she didn't know how the sack was gone until the officer woke her up. And she couldn't imagine why anybody would want to run off with her husband's bones, that her husband had been lynched in Mississippi 15 years ago, and that they wouldn't let her cut him down, and that she left town, and that when she came back, the body had dropped off the rope of its own accord, so she collected it and tried to bury it, but the funeral peoples wanted $50 for a coffin, and the carpenter wanted $12.50 for a pine box. She just didn't have no $12. So she just carried off what was left of Mr. Solomon, she always called him Mr. Solomon, because she was such a dignified colored man, and put it in a sack and kept it with her. White people want to hear this. Okay, you poor little nigger lady, we'll let you go. She quotes the Bible. I'm going to skip that part. And then, here we'll end here. Milkman is still telling the story. And then we got in the car and there was a change. Pilate was tall again. The top of her head wrapped in a silk rag almost touched the roof of the car as did theirs. And her own voice was back. She spoke, but to Macon only, and nobody else spoke at all. In a conversational tone, like somebody picking up a story that had been interrupted in the telling, she told her brother something quite different from what she told the policeman. And then she told him the story that I told you about the bones and where this is where they came from. This is why I had them, Macon. And then she says, I've had these bones ever since. Papa told me too, and he was right, you know. You can't take a life and walk off and leave it. This becomes more than just a bag of bones. This is her metaphor for life. How do you treat this cousin? Like a brother. You can't take a life and walk off and leave it. And she continues, life is life. Precious. And the dead you kill is yours. They stay with you anyway in your mind. So it's a more better thing to have the bones right there with you wherever you go. That way it frees up your mind. Well, she learns how to fly, and that's a whole other story. So, any questions? We've got a couple minutes. There are copies in the bookstore. I get 10% of everyone's soul. Anybody, any observations? Those of you who have read it?
I haven't read it. I'd like to go back to the point where she's talking about 3 minutes for this man to fall and die. And what I was hearing and what I was visualizing was she was back in the forest again where this man had become so frightened. Mm-hmm. And she was in essence that 3 minute period that she imagined was the life going out of not only herself but out of that man, and she turns him loose and he falls away from
her. Yeah. That's good. Write that down and then pass that on. And what you emphasize there is that imagination, the 19th century English poets speak to this the most, I think, the most directly. The only place to find truth is in imagination, because that takes us out of this reality that we live in all the time. Who can imagine, in my analogy earlier, every street full of dandelions? We can't even imagine that. Who could imagine a black president? Who can imagine, I just looked at this thing, I told you that, women could vote. Who can imagine that a gay pastor could be in the front of a Lutheran church? Who can? So these poets that look at imagination say that's where the truth is. And I think this is part of what happens in this book. How important is the purpose? We each decide that as readers, but the purpose of this book is, I think all literature that's good literature, is to lift us up out of this reality we live in. Is there another imagination? The greatest storyteller of all time, Jesus. All these little stories he tells, taking us on a whole new imaginative world. Imagine forgiving your son who took all his money and ran off. Imagine helping the guy on the street when he's your enemy. Go ahead, David.
A different sort of vein of observation that about when you're talking about belonging and what is owned, and you have just Macon, and then in the scene with the knife, he's talking, or is the daughter's name Reba?
Reba, yeah.
Yeah, Reba, how like Reba belongs to Pilate. I think that was in that phrase, and just and what you read, and just struck me about the. If you're talking about the dichotomy of what it means to belong or what it means to own, that you have this relationship, as opposed to the rental properties, and that's
very good. And owning people, or people being owned by systems and cultural values and so on, that's very good. But owning through, Pilate loves Reba. And at the end of the book, Pilate's last words in the book are, I wish I'd have known more people, because if I'd have known more, I'd have loved more. Mm-hmm. Unconditional. And that's why the kids steal her gold, and she goes to bail them out. That's why she said, I've been worried sick about you too, Macon. You know, joking, but that's at the height. Yes?
You said her last name was Dead?
Yeah.
I was fascinated by the fact when she held on to this fellow, 3 minutes after Dead let go of him, he dies.
Yeah. That's very good. And that's a great connection, an understanding of names and of symbols and of metaphors that she's dead, but she might be the most alive character in the novel. She can never die. Milkman says that. Milkman comes around. He goes through the stripping process too. If you read the novel, you'll see him in this run through the forest. He's still trying to get the gold. He thinks that the gold, now he found out it wasn't in her house, it might be back in the cave. And he thinks, I'm going to go out and find it. And in the process of searching for the gold, he comes to a whole new realization. And part of it is he loses his billfold in the woods. And then his tie falls off, and he loses his watch. And one by one, he is physically stripped of the things that give him power and identity. And he realizes, you know what, if I had my money here, it wouldn't help anyway. He's out in the middle of the woods. And in for the first time in his life, he can love somebody and reach, because he put away every assumption he had to begin at zero. That's a great observation. Anybody else? 7:15. I'll never go over. But sit down because we've got a test. No.